Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org, I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to follow the science on marijuana. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. There is no safe drug supply unless it comes from a legal pharmacy. If you are around anyone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an undercover conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Undercover, because we have a special guest who works in law enforcement undercover. Here's a story from a recent bulletin. August 4th, 2023, Lane County, Oregon. Law enforcement busted a massive illegal marijuana grow and cockfighting operation. They found 1,700 plants, $11,000 in U.S. currency, and 5 guns. A nearby stream was found to be dammed and diverting water away from the local community to illegal marijuana grows. The property owner, Thong Gan Phan Du Vong, I'm sure I'm butchering that name, was hosting cockfights on the property several times a year, attracting attendees from outside Oregon. Cockfighting? Boy, that just really sounds gross to me. But the positive part of the story is that I learned that participating in cockfighting is illegal and the attendees were cited. The story doesn't end there, because identifying a grow is one thing and citing the offenders is one thing, but then comes the hard part, the cleanup. Cleanup of an illegal grow takes several years and can cost more than $40,000 per grow. It involves complicated disposal of pesticides and other hazardous waste. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hello, Dr. Lev. Thank you for High Truths and your advocacy. My name is Charles Porter, and I work in the prevention field in the Skid Row neighborhood of Los Angeles. In my work, I've seen the public health impacts of institutional racism, poverty, and related disparities. This year, I've been working to support the Cannabis Child Safety Act and also working to raise awareness about an effort to legalize psychedelics. It's baffling to see efforts to increase drug access at a time when we have such a drug crisis. My question is about marijuana and law enforcement. What can we learn from law enforcement's handling of marijuana 20 years ago compared to how it is handled today? And what are some of the known disparities regarding enforcement impacting Black and Indigenous people of color? I look forward to your response. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles, so very much for your question. And more importantly, on the activism you have on passing the Cannabis Child Safety Act, protecting babies from poisoning of marijuana, especially gummies, children under the age of 2, many a day come to emergency departments across California and across the country because of exposure to marijuana, high potency products that end up kids being admitted to the ICU and even on ventilators. And against legalization of psychedelics and the normalization of drug use in general. To answer your question and discuss much more, I've invited an undercover agent, Joe Doakes. Joe works in marijuana education and law enforcement for over 40 years in California. He has experience in pre-hospital care and disaster rescue missions. He has experience as an undercover agent in the field of illegal marijuana grows. To learn more about Joe Doakes, check out the High Truth show notes. Joe Doakes, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you, Dr. Lev. It's a privilege to be here today with you.
I am excited and been really looking forward to this undercover conversation. You're going to be all, undercover here, and for our listeners cannot see you, but we've kind of have you blurred for this conversation because of your profession and because of what you have to say. It's sad that that's the case, but Joe, tell us about yourself and your work.
Well, Ronit, currently in my life, I focus on marijuana 24/7. My history is this. I have been a peace officer. It started in the 1970s. I started on the East Coast with a large East Coast department, moved very quickly to the West Coast, and worked my entire career with Los Angeles County Sheriff. During that time, I had the privilege of being in the most elite tactical special weapons team and narcotics unit in the United States, and had the opportunity to serve hundreds of search warrants and work up cases. I worked as a patrol deputy in the 1980s in South Central Los Angeles, and my focus at that time was on cocaine, which was flooding our streets, coming from South America at the time, and the street gangs in South LA ended up making rock cocaine out of powdered cocaine, and that was exported across the country, including gang violence. That took me through a majority of my career, worked on phencyclidine, was very popular back in the 80s in the ghettos of South PCP. Los Angeles. PCP, phencyclidine, PCP.
Yeah. And it's making a comeback now, actually.
And it's making a comeback. The other, there were some designer drugs that were out there, MDMA and things like that. There was some LSD, but I doubt that it actually was. It was probably other drugs. I didn't see many natural drugs like peyote. You didn't see that on the street. That was probably more down toward the border. Didn't see a lot of marijuana, and didn't see marijuana until about, and didn't do anything about marijuana. It was pretty much off our radar as far as drug enforcement, unless we got a major player that was transporting, you know, a tractor trailer full, that would pique our interest. But otherwise, we didn't really touch marijuana. And the marijuana that was in the United States was coming out of the Emerald Triangle of Humboldt and those areas, Mendocino, and those areas in Northern California. And it was pretty low grade marijuana, Dr. Lev. It was in the 3% THC, and it really wasn't a problem. And so we didn't. And the cartels weren't involved in it at the time. But in 1996, when we came about with the medical marijuana laws here in California, Prop 215, marijuana started to take off. And by 2000, I was already getting into my retirement time. But by 2000, my focus from what I would call hard drugs switched over to marijuana. And at that time, I had retired. Now we're getting up into 2007, and I had retired, and I moved up to Northern California and lived in a part of Northern California that is part of the very famous growing regions for marijuana in California. I began to focus on it solely, and that's what I do 24/7 now, is I focus on marijuana. That took me into first the prevention route, and so I became part of a coalition, 501c3, and then I started actually my own coalition, which is called SCAM, or Shasta, Siskiyou, and Lassen County Citizens Against Marijuana, and it's a tri-county group of activists in our communities that are speaking up against what happened. Fast forward to 2014, 2016, now we have the recreational marijuana, which under Prop 64 made it legal for people to possess up to 6 plants in the state of California and be able to grow that. By that time, marijuana growing had metastasized in the state of California and just exploded, and actually exploded all over California. And I know even down in your communities, down in, you know, Temecula, San Diego communities, Riverside, North Los Angeles, they exploded in grows. So what happened here was certain factions moved in. Now we have all the factions of growers. We have the Hmong, we have the Chinese, we have the Eastern Europeans and Russians, and we have what I call the white boy cowboy opportunistic growers, that all of a sudden you could grow marijuana law enforcement was either overwhelmed or wasn't doing anything about it. It was simply a misdemeanor and still is simply a misdemeanor to grow anything. If you grow 7 plants or 7 million plants illegally, it's still just a misdemeanor. I personally have never seen a legal grow in my career. I don't do anything with legal grows. They don't exist in my world. I only deal with illegal marijuana. So in my county, we focused on bringing in some of the most progressive anti-marijuana laws in the state of California. So we are a no hemp county, because hemp to me is simply low grade marijuana, and we have the inability as patrol deputies to be able to test for hemp in the field. It requires a $25,000 testing device if we want to test hemp in the field. So hemp is simply a disguise for growing marijuana. And what we found in our county is that when we allowed hemp for a very short period of time, the growers were simply growing a 15-foot circumference of hemp and then growing marijuana on the inside, and you couldn't tell the difference. You know, as a patrol deputy, if you went out there to look at it, you got a complaint, you wouldn't know what to do with that. So we decided that we would outlaw hemp. And so we did that. The next thing that we did is we outlawed all outdoor grows. And we tried outdoor grows for a couple of years in this county. And there wasn't any way to control it in any way. We didn't have the personnel to address it. We couldn't test it. So we went ahead and we outlawed all outdoor grows. So in this county, we allow indoor marijuana growing, and you are supposed to, under the law, be able to grow 6 plants for personal use. Now, I also have never seen that. When I go in to see an indoor grow here, which is quasi-legal, normally what you'll see is a typical single-family dwelling. They'll have a 2 or 3 car garage, and when you go in to look, it's not 6 plants; it's 100 plants growing in a 3 car garage, from floor to ceiling, grow lights, fertilizer, watering systems, and everything needed, and grow lamps. It's all in there for marijuana. So that's what's actually occurring here today. So we went ahead and we outlawed outdoor grows. Didn't slow down the outdoor grows at all. They just proliferated over the years. We are a no marijuana advertising county. Now that is extremely important. We pushed hard for that law, and it was codified in Prop 64. And so we got together with some other groups and sued the state of California, and were successful that the Prop 64 language was not being enforced. And there's a couple of attorneys that took that on, and congratulations to them for getting that successful. We actually had marijuana advertising that went up on the 5 freeway here for about 2 weeks. And we went to our county and took the law to our county council, and he immediately wrote a ordinance and made it illegal, and the signs were down. 2 weeks and a day, the signs were gone. If you go to places where dispensaries are in the state of California or some cities or counties, you will see marijuana advertising on the freeway. It hasn't been stopped because the people that run those cities and counties perhaps either aren't educated that under Prop 64, certain locations, it's illegal to have marijuana signage. And we also know statistically, wherever there's marijuana signage, Roni, the harm aspect is reduced. So the young people see all these signs up advertising for marijuana. Oh, it's got to be okay. They're advertising it. So we have no dispensaries in our county, and that's incredibly important. When you have dispensaries in a county, once again, the harm reduction is to youth. They see, oh, there's these dispensaries, it must be okay. And you also know, and I experience when I go into our schools, when we talk to our young people, and I have some sobering statistics that your listeners might be interested in. In our county, we do the drug education for our county. 95% of our students, high school students, have been exposed to marijuana in the last 30 days. It doesn't mean that they used it, but they talked about it. They had friends that used it. They went to a party where it was being used, or they know somebody in school that is selling it. And that is how most young people in our schools today are accessing marijuana. They're getting it from someone who's...
With all the prevention work that you're doing, like no billboards, you know, no outdoor grows, really pretty, you know, impressive rules that you've set up. Is that helping your statistics? Do you rate better in is it Shasta County compared to other counties in California?
I don't think so, because I tell you, Renee, this past year, I not only did I tour the state of California and talk to sheriffs from all over our state and talk to administrators from all over our state, and we go to the statewide youth conferences and talk to them. It doesn't appear that all of these laws really have any effect, because the people that are involved in the marijuana trades, they just ignore them, because they know that it's very hard to get prosecuted. And there is so much money now in the marijuana trade that even very staunch conservatives that would support, you would never think would support marijuana. For example, in our last Board of Supervisors race, we had two candidates that accepted marijuana money from the marijuana industry. And that would be a death knell in the past. You wouldn't get a politician that would take that money. So today they're extending the marijuana industry is extending its money politically and using that for political favor. And has it had an effect in this county? Not yet, but I think it probably will. And the only reason it hasn't had an effect on us is we pushed him on the marijuana issue, and he made it one of the cornerstones of his campaign. And he said, I will go after illegal marijuana. I will take back our county, and I will not give up land. He said, once we do an eradication, we will not let them come back and grow again. And I'll describe more of that later. Let me finish with the last and probably the most important aspect of one of the things that we push for. And this was recent in the last year. We push for what's called a no water wasting ordinance. So you cannot use water to grow an illegal substance, i.e. marijuana. Our sister county to the north, Siskiyou, just lost a major case that will have repercussions throughout the state of California. They gave up fighting the Hmong growers, who were very, very well funded and had fought the county for several years and had filed several lawsuits and obtained TROs against the county, saying that they were being picked on and being racially profiled.
Tell us what TRO is.
A temporary restraining order. So okay. a federal judge came in. They filed a case in federal court saying that they were being racially profiled. They got the ACLU behind
them. The illegal marijuana growers said that they were being filed.
Illegal marijuana growers. And this was in an area called Shasta Vista. There's 8,000 grows, 8 to 12,000 grows in there that go on for miles. And they have been described in many stories in the LA Times, the Vice News, Tucker Carlson's news company. They've all been up here and they've shown this, but nothing. It still didn't affect the federal judge, Kimberly J. Mueller, ruling that the county, that water is determined to be a human right, and that the county was required to go into mediation with the growers. And that county is a very poor county. I know that it's hard for your listeners that are in other places in California, but there are rural counties that are very poor. And Siskiyou is a county of 44,000 residents, very low median income, and they didn't have the legal infrastructure, and they didn't have the money to be able to fight the ACLU, and the federal judge required them to go into mediation. And as of several weeks ago, we're still waiting for the final order, but as of several weeks ago, the county said it is going to go ahead and pay the legal fees of the people that brought the TROs, and there was two lawsuits there, and that they're going to drop going after water. Now, that county had gone after water, and they had targeted this particular area, and that's why they probably lost their case. In our case, in our county to the south, we have a different
And what do you mean they lost their case? The illegal grows are allowed to steal water from the residents?
Yes. So I shared some pictures with you. There were in this area called Shasta Vista, where these 8,000 to 12,000 illegal grows are. It's in a subdivision. And so what happened is there were some commercial farmers who came in from out of county and bought these large farms that had big, huge commercial wells on them that they would that were drilled and used and paid for by the government to grow alfalfa and food plots. And instead, they decided they would market their water to the Hmong growers who had bought land you could buy a couple acre plot in there originally for $2,500 to $4,000. There's no power, there's no water, there's no septic, there's no infrastructure. They would buy this land, and it's just simply scrub land on the north side of Mount Shasta, one of the seven sacred mountains in the United States. And I have a picture of a grow that we were actually eradicating that I've sent to you that is at the base of Mount Shasta. So that's the area that we're speaking about. So what happened is these growers showed up, and they made a deal to buy water from these farmers, and there are hundreds of water trucks every day, illegal water trucks that transport water from these commercial wells into these grows. So the sheriff at the time, they went ahead and targeted that, and they targeted the water trucks, and the Hmong ended up suing them, saying that they were being discriminated against. And the federal judge decided that water was a human right and that they had a right to water. Now, they don't have a right to use water illegally, but the plaintiffs that brought the lawsuit said, oh, we're just poor farmers. We just want to have some animals, and we want to grow some corn. And the judge appeared to be siding with them. So this has been in a 3-year battle. So instead of the judge looking at the evidence, was there actually discrimination, you know, any of the things that they had brought, the judge said, I'm ordering you into mediation. And the county simply said, you know, you've got to understand, Renit, they have a district attorney's office that has, what, 3 people in it? And that includes the district attorney. They simply didn't have the infrastructure to continue to fight. So they said, we're going to go ahead and settle, and we're going to just pay the legal fees, and they can take the water, and we'll address it in other ways. Doesn't mean they won't go after illegal marijuana, but that county is the size of Rhode Island, and they have a couple of deputies to be able to do enforcement. So marijuana proliferated in that county and became the epicenter of illegal growing in the United States. When I went around the United States this past year, and I speak to cannabis boards and board of supervisors and town councils from other states, and I look at what their marijuana issues are, California, you know, it started in Colorado with the legalization in Colorado, but it didn't really export to other states at the time. Once California took on marijuana, we exported it because 80% of our marijuana product or more goes out of state. It doesn't stay here in California. It's not used domestically. And of the marijuana that stays here domestically, and this is what the dispensaries tell us, most of that goes into the dispensaries. You know, when you think you're going down to a dispensary and you're getting this organically grown, you know, chemically free product, that in our estimation and what labs like Enresco labs report is that most of that marijuana is coming from illegal grows. And now there are reports that 100% of illegal marijuana is tainted in the state of California. That is my personal experience.
I want to emphasize that a second. First of all, the points that you're making. Point number one, if I go as a consumer to a dispensary, one of these, you know, beautiful shops that look like a Apple store, how do I know that the product I'm buying comes from a legal market with all sorts of pesticides and insecticides versus a legal grow?
Well, I would say
do I have any knowledge of where this product is coming from?
Well, we know that the Department of Cannabis Control, which is supposed to do seed to sale and is supposed to do all the testing of marijuana in the state of California and qualify those tests, What we know from the private industry is we know that the testing agencies, that first of all, dispensaries are pretty selective. They go to the testing agency where they just do batch testing. So you don't know that the individual product that you're actually buying, there is no definitive way to know that that product is clean and pure. It's just not possible. We know that there have been reports, again, in Resco Labs, Quest Labs. There's a lot of reports in the industry, and you can go on the marijuana sites like marijuanabiz.com, and they self-report that there are all these labs that are falsifying these tests because it's all about money. And so I don't think there's really any definitive way for you to know with 100% certainty that the product that you're getting is pure and untainted. We know, and I know from my personal experience, seeing everything, because all I deal is with illegal grows, 100% of what's coming out of an illegal grow today is highly toxic. And as an example, I sent you a picture of 55 gallon drums of chemicals we're finding in the grows. And one of those chemicals is methacrylate. And methacrylate is used by the growers. We call it super glue. It's actually a glue that's used as a spray coating on glasses to when you tint the glasses for UV. So the growers are using methacrylate in 55 gallon drums. So it tells you how much they're using to spray on the plants to hold more pollen on the plants because they think it's going to accentuate their yield of marijuana. I've looked at some of those chemicals. We've traced them back to chemical houses in New York and all the way to Brazil. So we know that a lot of this stuff is coming from out of the country. I know this sounds strange to you, but we've actually followed trucks, tractor trailers with loaded with bags of what appears to be fertilizer, but it all has Chinese markings on it. And when we get pictures of it, it's none of it's legal in the United States. And of course, I also sent you a picture of there's actually the Department of Pesticide Resources in the state of California has actually put out a manual now for law enforcement because of so many toxic chemicals that we come across as law enforcement. And my real fear, Ronit, is that we're going to see our law enforcement we're always exposed to these chemicals. You'd have to be in a level one hazmat suit not to experience some of these chemicals. I'm worried about the weird cancers that these deputies and law enforcement are going to get in 20 years from cutting down all of this marijuana. When we go to do the anatomy of eradication works like this, Ronit. So normally we work on what's called community complaints. So we'll get a community complaint about a grow area. And it's usually because the growers have been threatening the community members. And in some cases, they show up at their house at night, they show up with a bag of money, and they show up with guns, and they say, we want to buy your house, you have water, it's time for you to leave. And if they don't leave, they get their houses vandalized. And this has happened extensively in this area of what's called A12 in Siskiyou County. So the growers will get these neighborhood complaints. So we'll start working up a search warrant, and that requires a lot of work. Even though a lot of these grows you can actually see from the street as you drive along, as you drive through this area, I mean, they don't hide them. This is third world marijuana up here, where you have lookouts who are on all the corners of all of these roads, armed lookouts. They're all equipped with radios. Any stranger that comes into the community, you can't drive into these grow areas. You'll be stopped. And as the LA reporter that was up here found out, got all their windows smashed out and got threatened with being killed and had to get out of there with just their life. And there's no law enforcement. You could call law enforcement, but there's no deputies. So it's incredible. So this is the beginning of how we work up a search warrant.
It sounds like lawlessness, third world.
It's absolute. It is. I have offered every single.
We don't
single,
think that exists in the United States.
No, I have offered this to editor, every congressperson, every political person, every news person that I ever talked to. I said, "Come with me. It'll have to be armed escort, and we'll take you up there, and we'll show you that." And I invite you too, Roni, we'd get a plane. I wouldn't put you on the ground up there, but I get a plane and take you around and show it to you in a plane. Come and see what's going on in the United States and why Governor Newsom has been absolutely absent and has been abjectly, it's treason for what he's allowed to happen up here. And there may be a reason for that, because mm-hmm. these northern counties voted on his recall. And I think it's a little bit of payback. We don't get any state. We don't get any state help up here. We complain to the state water board.
What about federal help?
The feds are hands off. The feds are hands off on marijuana because they've made it a states' rights issue. And so we don't get federal help. Now, when it becomes transnational, which is the Sinaloa cartel is controlling transnational marijuana up here in the northern part of California. And the feds will go after potentially them, but we don't get any federal help. There's no, it's all done locally and it's all done with local money. So we have the beginning of this search warrant. So then we have to go in and we have to do all the legal parameters for a search warrant. We have to go and we have to document the grow. We have to find out who actually owns this parcel. And in the case of this one area, they have so smart that they can flip titles the same day. So we don't actually know who owns this parcel many times. And the names are swapped front and back, and they're all foreign names. This area is predominantly Hmong and Chinese growers that I'm speaking about. They're very adept at using the system.
Are they Americans? Are they American immigrants? Yeah. Or are they foreign?
So they claim to be immigrants of and that they all helped America in the Vietnam War, and when they have then there have been protests up here of them, where they'll stand in front of the county courthouse saying how they're being targeted, and they put on American soldier uniforms and ribbons, but none of those people could possibly be alive. So these are second and third generation, and there is a street gang that was fomented in Minnesota called the MOD, or Menace of Destruction Street Gang, and it came to California in the 1980s and moved to the Fresno area, where it became problematic. Their primary source of income was marijuana growing. So they became the growers. And many of the growers up here will have Fresno addresses or Minnesota addresses. So we have this, now we're beginning in the search warrant process. So we have to fly it. So we fly it with drones. They shoot at our drones. They shot at my drone. They, they try to shoot your drone down because you can't go in there in person. During eradication operations, it's incredible. The last news agency I took in there with us, we drove in and literally the cars were coming out of this area by the hundreds. And as soon as we got to the grows that we're going to hit, the cars would come back in and they'd park a quarter mile away from us. And I've got to tell you, they are not afraid of law enforcement. They've told the sheriff before, we're not afraid of you. There's more of us than you. And it's problematic when we do an eradication. So we end up writing the search warrant. So then we have to go to the district attorney. We go to the judge. We say, okay, we've discovered who this parcel is. They're growing illegal marijuana. Here's pictures of it. And the judge signs off on a warrant. Then we actually have to work up a raid. And in my county, it's much easier because we have a marijuana team that's funded. We got funding for our team and we go after federal money. And so we're better equipped. In that county, there's no help. There's no law enforcement. So they put together reserve deputies and volunteers, and they cobble together and try to do the worst of the worst. They're lucky if they can do 50 warrants a year up there of the thousands of illegal grows. They're very lucky. So then what happens is we'll get to actually a location, and usually the growers many times have been trafficked in either from Minnesota, or in our case here in our county, they come in from Mexico. They've been trafficked in. They get paid $100 a day. They live in absolutely squalid conditions. The water that's been trucked in this non-potable illegal water that's been trucked in. They use it for everything, you know, bathing, cooking, eating, whatever. And that also, they keep these large swimming pools where they dump the water into, and they do a chemical mix, and that chemical mix is what feeds all the grows. So we'll run into the grow. Normally the growers will run out because they know that we're not going to chase them, and we can't chase them, Renit. It's a misdemeanor, and you're not going to get hurt chasing somebody through the woods. We can't deploy our canines because they put poison on the ground to kill all the animals. And there are no animals, completely devoid. There's no birds. There's no deer. There's no small rodents. There's no jackrabbits, nothing. They have killed every bit of wildlife in there. As a matter of fact, and I just sent you an email on this 2 weeks ago during eradication operations. We found what was unusual, we hadn't seen before. We were finding these plastic drink bottles and soup cans, and they were the plastic bottles were burnt and melted to the ground, but the soup cans had this charred residue in them, and we found what appears to be to us precursors to make a sarin type gas that they light off in the grows to kill any possible, it's an organic phosphate to kill anything possible. They don't even want that. Our leaders don't even want that information to get out, because if there was ever a wildfire up there, they'd be worried about a potential sarin gas cloud going through the community. Now this area, there's not many local residents left anymore. It's pretty much just growers, because the local residents have all been threatened or just have gotten tired. If you're there every single day, there's a toxic plume of smoke going up in the air. And I'm trying to describe this as a verbal picture, word picture for your audience, so they can understand how bad it is. They burn all of their trash, and all of their plastics are burned. So when they do their hoop houses and they go from clear plastic, black plastic, and they get done at the end of the year, they cut that off and they just throw it in a pile and they burn everything. And so
it boggles my mind that California most Californians, you know, care about the environment, about the land. We want to go green. We want to outlaw regular cars and allow only electric cars. And yet right under our noses, we've got third world destruction of wildlife and our environment and our water.
And Ronin, we complain to every single state agency, up and down, all of them, Cal EPA, Cal Pesticide Regulation. We even complain to the Department of Agriculture, because what people don't know is if you enter the state of California with an agricultural product, you're stopped at a state inspection station. And there's a number of them up on the border there.
I've gone through that. I thought that they should be in charge of like terrorist attack, because they're going to find my one apple that I had in my car and confiscate it.
That's right. You couldn't bring a banana in from Oregon.
I told them, you guys should work for TSA. You're so good at finding my apple.
Guess what? They don't stop marijuana from coming into the state of California. So we have all of these clones that come in from Oregon through our borders. And, you know, I've gotten up to mid-level with the California Department of Agriculture on this. And they say, well, we're not enforcement. You know, we'll notify the California Highway Patrol. And I said, yes, but this meets the pure definition of what a toxic non-native weed is. And if you're allowing it into the state of California, well, we can't do anything about it because, you know, our agents aren't armed and we don't want to have confrontations at our inspection stations. And so we are allowing, not only are we allowing all this illegal marijuana growing, we're allowing it to come in from other states and to be exported to other states with, you know, and they say, well, we report it to California Highway Patrol. Again, Renit, up here, you'll have one California Highway Patrolman for maybe, I don't know, 200 square miles. He's not going to ever be able to find that vehicle again when it comes through an inspection station. It's just not possible.
Sounds pretty scary.
So
people don't care about the land, and they don't care about the environment, and they don't care about, you know, foreign people coming and doing that. What about, and you mentioned this, and you're doing a documentary on this. What about animals? People, what about the animal rights activists who, you know, care about our animals that are being destroyed and killed?
So I sent you a picture of a typical marijuana grow dog, and marijuana dogs are used for either security or they're used as bait dogs. So the growers do war among themselves. It's not like we get calls for law enforcement.
What's a bait dog? I don't know what a bait dog is.
Okay, so what will happen is one grower will begin a war with another grower for whatever reason. You know, you're taking too much of my water. Your marijuana is better than mine. Whatever reasons, they get into a war with each other. And see, they'll have these packs of dogs. And when you go into the grows up here, you'll see wild packs of dogs running along the road. There's no animal control here. Okay, again, very rural county. There's maybe an animal control officer in one of the city contract cities, but there's no infrastructure to control animals. So, and they allow the animals to just breed at will. So there's all these wild dogs running around. So what will happen is they'll take a dog and they will chain it to a fence outside of their grow. The other grower who has all of his dogs, his security dogs or whatever, his dogs will go and find this dog that's chained to a fence, cannot protect itself. They wire them to the fence. And I sent you a picture of a dog that was wired to a fence. The other dogs will attack the bait dog, and then that grower will end up shooting all of those dogs. Problem solved. Now, we don't get calls for the dead dogs, but we know that it happens. Also, at the end of the year, and I'll be sending you just a film clip of part of the documentary. And just so you know, I have sent out a document to all of the animal rights organizations on this, and it's not one of them has responded back with, "Wow, we need to do something about this." It's just
wow.
Been hands
off. They don't care about people killing dogs.
Nope. Best friends, any AKs, all the big, you know, all the big clubs in America. We work with some of our California partners who have good connections there, and very surprised. They just don't want to see it. Once we show them the pictures of the dogs, they don't want any part of it. I don't know why. I can't understand why.
Tell us about this documentary that you're doing.
So I am a dog lover. I've had a canine in my life. Been a part of my life. I like dogs more than I like people, Ronit, because
many
dogs
people
don't lie
do
to us. Yes, I know. So we decided that the only way to bring this up as a issue and get people to be behind the issue and understand how deadly this issue is in our country with marijuana growing. And how horrible these marijuana growers are as criminals, and they are criminals, is to show how the animals are being abused. And we went and interviewed a gal in Siskiyou County called Georgine Murphy. She runs an animal rescue there, mostly for marijuana dogs. And she is in one of the marijuana grower regions of Doris, California. 1,500 residents, small city right up on the northeast corner of California. 1,500 residents, and there are 1,500 illegal grows. So that tells you that, and there's no sheriff even there. There's no sheriff assigned. There's no substation. The sheriff would have to come from 60 miles away to do any law enforcement up there. So very little marijuana eradication goes on. So what happens is the growers bring in all these dogs and they chain them up. And of course we've had, and what's really, really depressing about this interview with her is that during our wildfires, the growers, they just take off, they just leave, or they get to the end of the grow season. You know, they've made their $100,000 to $500,000 in profit for the season, and they leave. They go back to Minnesota, they go to wherever they came from, and they'll leave the dogs. And sometimes they just leave the dogs chained up, or in the wildfires, they just leave the dogs chained or wired to a fence. And we're talking about being wired with barbed wire to fences, not even just like a leash or something like that. And they leave and the dogs burn up, or they get eaten by the other dogs, or if there's any wildlife and there isn't anymore, that area I speak of, Doris, used to have, there's an area up there called Mud Lake that used to have herds of elk and deer, nothing. They've been all shot and they've been all poisoned. There's nothing left up there. And Mud Lake, which used to have water in it about half of the year, it really is just mud now because the growers moved around it and drained the lake completely dry for the water source. So she decided that her life mission was to go ahead and take care of these dogs. And so she started a 501c3. She bought an old school up there. She's trying to rehabilitate it. And she takes in all these dogs. So they'll come running out of the hills. And they normally run to the sound of other dogs. And so she'll find them. They'll be heavily abused. She'll get them all the vet care they need, and she'll try to get them adopted out. If they're unadoptable, they have permanent residence in her sanctuary for life. So I think when people see what is happening to the animals, I had hoped that by doing this documentary that I would gain so much anger and desire from the population to do something that it would bring more enforcement. I don't know how that's going to work. The sheriff there, his name is Jeremiah LaRue. He's a rock star. He's the youngest sheriff in California, and with little to no resources, he's trying his best to do something to keep the community safe. And he asked us. He's done a number of interviews. He did an interview on California Today. Excellent interview if you want to watch him, Jeremiah LaRue, California Today. Worth watching to see what's going on. And he asked us to participate with him on getting out the message on the animals. And so I don't know when the documentary is going to finish, because we are currently working on undercover operations right now, and we're in the height of our season. So it'll probably be sometime next year that I'll have time to finish up on that documentary.
Is there a title to it?
The Pot Dogs from Misery to Hope.
Oh, wow. All right. We'll be on the lookout for that.
You won't want to see the pictures. And that's the problem, is when we try to show people the pictures, or some of the pictures are so graphic, people go, oh, no, that can't be happening. No, that's the dog's testicles cut off. That can't be happening. And so they don't want to see that. And we don't know how we're going to make that palatable to the general public so they can see actually what's going on. I'll send you the pictures. You're a doctor. You've seen all that stuff.
I don't know. It's still disturbing.
It's absolutely disturbing.
Very disturbing. All right. So Siskiyou County lawlessness, and really, devoid of regular citizens, just used for illegal grows, which goes, from these grows to the pot shops. We don't know where people don't know where their pot's coming from. And I can't imagine with all the quantity of illegal grows that does not reach the consumer.
We just eradicated in just several search warrants in Siskiyou County. Actually did get the state water board team to come in, and they wrote 50 search warrants. They took out $68.5 million of marijuana on just a handful of grows, $68.5 million. So when we're talking about the amount of money coming out of California for marijuana, it's in the billions with a B. We know that just Siskiyou County, I've spoken to, there's so much money coming out of the county that we spoke to a DEA forensic financial analyst. And what we were instructed was the only way that we know how much money is coming out of California is we have to go to the central bank, and strictly in marijuana money. We have to go to the central bank and we watch how marijuana money is being moved around the United States. And it was just... the amount of money is staggering. It might be a $39 billion industry this year in the United States, but I don't know how many billions are just coming out of that one county. So I don't know. And it's all illegal. It's all cash. And we're never going to be able to put that back in the bottle. People say, well, let's just legalize marijuana everywhere and it'll all straighten out. These are criminals, ladies and gentlemen. They are not going to comply with the law ever. They have made so much money at this. They are so good at it. It's not like even we say, hey, we're going to make you legal. They're not going to comply. They're not going to pay taxes. They've been used to working under the radar. And if they wanted to be legal, Ronit, it's been legal since 1996. You could go out and get a permit. They could get permits to grow legally, but then they'd fall under regulation and restriction, and they refuse to do that.
What's your estimate? I don't know if you know this, for percent legal grows versus illegal, or legal sales versus illegal. Isn't it 10 to 1 or?
Oh, it's 80% of the marijuana is illegal that's flowing into our legal market. It's the vast part of the legal marijuana money is coming from illegal sources.
Right. Crazy. So, Joe, the issue of marijuana is personal to you, both as a law enforcement and public safety officer, but also personally. And I thought you'd share with us a little bit about a friend of yours, Jeff, Mr. Malibu, and that adds to your passion of you know, advocating on the harms that marijuana can cause.
So this year, I'm going to call him JT. This year, JT's family has allowed me to release his story nationally in the hopes that other people and law enforcement would realize that how deadly this drug is. So JT was my trainee and as a deputy sheriff for Los Angeles. And as a trainee, you get assigned with a senior officer, a field training officer, for 6 months. Now, you've already done your time. You've gone through an academy. You've been sent to a custody facility. So you have 1 to 3 years experience already on the department. And then you come out and you have to go through a 6-week patrol school. And then you get assigned to a patrol deputy who's a field training officer for this 6 months. And during this 6 months, you evaluate this trainee on numerous aspects of being a policeman. And he has to pass all these certain tests, and he's on probation. And at any time, he can be what's called rolled up and removed from duty and be sent back to the jail and potentially fired if he doesn't pass training. So I had Jeff for 6 months. He was probably my best trainee. You form that bond with that person in a police car. It's like being married plus, because you know every single thing about that person. You look at every single aspect of their personality, and if they and policemen are brutal upon each other. If they have any hidden things about them or any weaknesses, they get identified and they get rooted out. And so in this 6-month period, it's very stressful. So Jeff completed his training. He did a good job. He came to me. He had been a paratrooper in the Army, so I was very happy to have somebody with some military experience. He was your typical beautiful Nordic god of a man. He was 6'3", 225 pounds. He was all muscle, beautiful blonde hair, and you know, big mustache. And the girls would just melt over this guy. And I was jealous of him, really, Renee, because I'm ugly compared to him. So our careers took different paths. It's a large department. You know, there's about 15,000 people on the department, and you go to different patrol stations or different things in your career. And so I kind of lost track of him as we moved around in our careers. But in the end of this career, I had already retired, and he was writing me. He did 31 years with LA County. And at the end of his career, he was writing me and said, "Hey, what's retirement going to be like?" And I was giving him suggestions on how to stay busy and stay healthy, and told him to move out of Los Angeles and find a good woman to marry. And there wasn't one in Los Angeles. He needed to get out of there to find somebody to marry. Anyway, he was in a lot of pain in the end of his career. And I don't think that there's any policeman today that goes through 31 years in law enforcement. And he stayed as a patrol deputy, which is unusual, Ronit. Most people promote. He stayed as a patrol deputy the entire time and worked Malibu at the end of his career. He became known as Mr. Malibu, and all the young deputies called him Dad. But he retired with 31 years, a lot of injuries, and he had been on, they had given him some typical, you know, pharma medication to help with his pain management. And I thought he was doing okay. At one point, he said he wanted to get off his pain pills. And I didn't even think about it. I said, "Okay, that's great. You're going to go natural. You're just going to get off all your pain meds." Unbeknownst to me, Rony, he went and he spoke to a bud tender. And the bud tender suggested that he start trying dabs, that it would help with his pain. And he didn't tell me any of this. This is after the fact that I found out what he was doing. About 6 months into this, and he would call me every week. About 6 months into this, he began having what I would call psychotic episodes. He would tell me things like, "Hey, the Hell's Angels are following me. They know who I am. They know where I am." I go, "Really?" He said, "Oh yeah. And my neighbors are shining lights in my windows at night because they know I've been a deputy." And he said, "I cut all the trees down between myself and my neighbors." And I go, "Jeff, that doesn't sound right. What's going on?" And at one point, I got a call from a friend of his who said, "I'm following Jeff. I'm on the 101 freeway. He's driving at 100 miles an hour. He's crazy. He thinks that people are after him." So I ended up calling my department and I said, hey, I'm Jeff's training officer. I'm retired now. He's retired, but I believe that he's lost it and he's ready for the rubber gun squad. He's ready for the green room of the rubber gun squad. I actually think he's 5150, a danger to self, danger to others, and gravely disabled. They sent deputies out to his home and paramedics, and they checked him, and he was able to pass the test. So they didn't take him at that point for 5150. It persisted, and these psychotic episodes kept getting worse, and he would call me at all hours of the day. And I kept calling the department, and I said, hey, you got to do something. You got to take his badge and gun away from him. Now, that's the most extreme thing that one policeman could ever do to another policeman is take their badge and gun away from him. But I said, this is what needs to happen. I said, Jeff, he's crazy. He's crazy, absolutely crazy now. Eventually, he did get 5150. He did a self-committal, and he was a vet, so they put him in the VA hospital. He was in there for a couple of weeks. He got dry off of THC exposure, which is what was going on with him. He came out, and he seemed a lot better. But very quickly, within a month or two, he started using high-potency THC again. And the episodes just immediately reappeared, Ronit. In the days before his life, he began to talk to me about death. Now, policemen talk about death like it's a matter of fact, because we see it all the time. You know, it is a part of our lives as a police officer. And in Jeff's career, he probably handled probably saw a couple hundred dead people. That wouldn't be unusual for somebody with 30 years experience to have to deal with that, make death notifications or see homicide victims. And he began talking to me about death, saying, hey, you know what? Death is great. He said, because you don't feel any pain anymore. And I just brushed it off as police talk. 3 days later, I told him at that point, hey, Jeff, you're crazy. You need to check yourself in. He didn't call me for the next 3 days. And I got a call from his family, and they say, we're extremely concerned about Jeff. He's been threatening our son. We're going to get a restraining order against him. And I said, well, I haven't heard from him. So they called the department and they sent deputies out. And Jeff had laid on his bed. He had taken a tactical knife and he had cut his own throat from ear to ear, Ronit. Now you tell me what kind of drug a person can take that can make them, one, so psychotic to be able to do that, and two, physically be able to accomplish that and kill yourself that way. It's incredible to me. He probably bled out for a long time, laid on his bed, and he was found the next day. The two deputies that found him, I also fear for them now. I feel for their mental well-being, because you don't want to find another policeman like in that condition. So I'm worried about what they might feel. His death was ruled by a suicide, and his tissues were saturated with THC. So the coroner didn't say, hey, suicide due to THC intoxication. In my opinion,
they never do that.
No.
We medical examiners don't report like cause suicide as suicide, but we do have data showing that suicide, people who died by suicide, the number one drug found in the system for age under 25, I know your friend is different, but the number one drug is THC in people who died by suicide under that age, way more than alcohol or any other drug at all. By far, THC stands out. So we do know that statistic. But how disturbing, again, really shame on my profession, the medical profession, that allows bud tenders or people with no education to act like doctors and recommend things. I mean, again, what I have to go through in order for me to recommend an aspirin for people, I'd lose my license if I didn't do the due diligence on, you know, risk benefit for doing that. So again, I think part of that is on us for allowing other people to pretend to be doctors when they're not. And the other thing is, when people are in psychosis, they don't have insight. They don't know that they're not being chased. He really believed that. You could see it from the outside, like, my friend's not my friend, but he doesn't see that. So tragic. I'm so sorry for his family, for you. It's hard to It's disturbing.
Every December, Jeff was born on December. And so every December, I still write to his family and just say, hey, I just want you to know, I haven't forgotten him. If someone who goes through what Jeff went through an entire career and being vetted psychologically, and we get vetted psychologically all the time. We don't just get vetted. You know, when you're a brand new deputy, you go through your, you know, you go through all the MMPIs and your psych tests, but throughout your entire career, you're being vetted all the time. Psychologically, you're having people look at you. And for him to get through his career and to have that happen to him, it is really is a tragedy, because if the strongest among us, Ronit, can fail because of high potency THC, think about what those people who are already predisposed to psychotic behavior or have schizophrenia already, think about what's happening to them. Our statistics up here is 39% currently of our hospital admissions for Mercy are testing positive for THC when we do a drug tox screen. I don't know what it is down there, but that's what's going on up here.
We did one study of all the drug screens that we obtain. Again, that's a very select group of people. Yes. 50% of those were positive for THC. I think we need to reach out to our psychiatrists that are very reluctant to make the diagnosis of cannabis-induced psychosis. And clearly, that's what Jeff had, because when he was off of it, he was back to normal. And he was not predisposed. He's an older gentleman. And I actually have a family member who ended up in the emergency department in psychosis. You know, family was frantic, not knowing what to do. And I said, wait, a person that age, you know, you're in your 50s, you don't get psychosis out of nowhere. That's drug induced. And the good part of it is if you make that diagnosis, it could be fixed. You're not going to have permanent schizophrenia because, you know, that's a reversible cause. So if that person understands what happened to them, and that's eliminated, then, you know, it's potentially reversible. So, but yeah, we know. And Dabs, what you were describing that he was taking, that's like 90%+ THC. That's more like methamphetamine. That's not like your early day weed.
No, I interviewed Ann Hassel, and Ann has written her book, Confessions of a Bud Tender. And she said that, and she was addicted to high potency THC and got sober. And Ann reported that in her dispensaries and all of her jobs that they couldn't sell anything that was less than 90% THC. And you see that in the dispensaries. Nobody wants low potency marijuana. They don't want to smoke bud anymore. The kids all want, you know, and the vape devices that we're finding in the schools now, they look like inhalers, nebulizers. They look like crayons that, you know, there are vape pens. And we actually, in our drug prevention, we go into some of the at-risk schools. And the last one I was in, it was almost like a WWE event. I was surprised the teacher could keep the door shut because all these kids were using high potency THC and they were stoned in class. They were using right while the teacher turns around to the blackboard, right while we were there giving drug education classes. And I explained to them, I said, look, you're all 17 right now, turning 18. I go, you're going to be adults next year. What are you going to do? And I kept posing that question to them. I go, where is your life going to go? Who's going to take care of you? I mean, are you going to live in mommy and daddy's basement till you're 25? And unfortunately, in California, many of them probably will, Ronit, but they will not be productive members of our society.
Well, I mean, if they have a home to go to, I think they're lucky. The thing is, people end up on the streets, which is way worse. So, you know, we've talked about drugs. You've had a long career in drugs. You've seen, you know, you said you started out with crack. I've talked about marijuana. Now, you know, really fentanyl is what's killing people. But you're here, you know, even talking to us undercover because you feel threatened as a law enforcement officer dealing with drug cartels. I just want to talk a little bit about what that's like. And is your threat just because of marijuana, or is it because of fentanyl or PCP or other drugs? And tell us about that experience.
Before I do, let me talk about fentanyl for a second and fentanyl and marijuana. Now, fentanyl and marijuana was a myth for a long time, but now statistically we are starting to see custody managers of custody facilities who are testing inmates, doing drug tox screens on inmates coming in, and the inmates are claiming the only drug that they use is marijuana, but they're testing positive for fentanyl. So we know that we're starting to see in the real low grade if you get a low-grade crop of marijuana and it's just junk, if you put a little fentanyl on it, one, you're addicting everybody, and two, they're going away happy. So we are starting to see that emerge.
Is it really? Do you think that I see that too in the emergency department? I'll have people who had to be woken up with Narcan and Narcan Save, and when they wake up, I ask them, well, what did you use? And they'll say, I swear it was only marijuana, I swear. It's like, but they're positive for fentanyl. And what I thought is that it's the bong or what the pipe that they were using may have had some residual fentanyl, and that's how they overdosed unintentionally rather than the plant itself being laced with fentanyl.
I don't know, Renit. I don't have an opinion on that. I think that it's just when you get the cartels, if they're going to lose a crop, and they have to take a crop out early or something like that, spray a little fentanyl on it, and they still have a completely marketable crop instead of trying to sell a pill, which might not sell because everybody knows fentanyl is bad. They can spray it on a crop and still sell it as marijuana. We're also seeing, and this statistic's important because you have to look at what is the greater harm.
But Joe, that's important. That's a important public health thing. Have you actually seen plants that you've gone to those grows that have fentanyl on there?
No.
Okay. That's a different public health education.
Right. Okay. I've seen plants with carbofuran on them, and you can't even walk in those grows because carbofuran is a deadly organophosphate, and you can't even walk in the grows. The smell is just, you can't go in a marijuana grow anyway. And one of the things during an eradication is we cut all the plastic off of the hoop houses first, and we let them air out before we take a skid steer inside. And you know, we can't even take the marijuana. We used to take the marijuana, Ronit, but back after about 2012, we were actually trying to clean up marijuana grows, but the cost in a small grow, single soup house grow, could be in excess of $50,000. So there is no hazmat cleanup anymore. Everything is bulldozed in situ into the ground. And in our case here in my county, we actually got what called destruction warrants. So we bulldoze the hoop houses and everything into the ground. It all goes into the ground. Generators, whatever's sitting there, and it's all toxic, Ronit, and it just gets bulldozed into the ground. Now we ask, and we red tag the properties, so the owners supposed to be responsible to clean them up, but I don't think it ever does. And many grows now in California, just so you know, the drug trafficking organizations, they do trespass grows where they'll just show up on land, raw land, and they'll start growing. Because you get an out of state or out of county owner, they don't know that somebody's there growing on their property. Or, as is also the case, the typical going amount right now is somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000 per grow season to rent a property, higher if it has water, lower if it doesn't. And so they'll just rent their properties to whomever. We've been trying to chase that as well, but it's incredibly difficult when they flip titles and you don't have any idea who owns the place and nobody ever takes responsibility. So we red tag them. We have PG&E come in. If there's any power there, we have the power removed. We've been trying to take the well. We're afraid of what happened in Siskiyou. So we've come up with a plan to, and we're proposing now to go to any, and these wells are drilled illegally. They'll come at night with a well drilling rig, and the well drilling rigs will come out of Oregon or Central California. There's not enough of them. They'll come up here, and for $50,000 to $100,000 in cash, they'll drill you a well overnight. They'll just stay there overnight and run that thing 24 hours until you have a well. So we'll go in, we'll dig in with, we want to dig with a backhoe, bend the well pipe over and GPS the well. That way we haven't destroyed the property, but we've made it so it's unusable until they come into compliance. That's what we're hoping to do. We're still trying to apply our water ordinance. One last statistic that's important for you. We run the DUI probation victim impact panel class for our county. And I would say back in 2010, we got maybe 5%, and they have to do a pre and post test. And in these pre and post tests, they talk about how their DUI came about and what substances they use. And I think the people are very honest because they know nothing's going to happen to them. And back then, about 5% of the population said they were using alcohol and marijuana as a part of their DUI. Today, that number is 50%. And this is what people are telling us. So it's probably higher if we actually knew. Yeah. We test them as they come into the class, and normally about 150 a month. And out of that 150, you'll get 15 that'll just raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm going to test positive right now for marijuana. And we refuse them entry, and then the rest come in. So why is that an important statistic? Because those people are around us driving 4,000 pound bullets down our freeways, crashing into us and killing us.
4,000 pound bullets. Yeah. I know it's hard. What is the reaction to the people when you give the education? Do they just roll their eyes and I'm here because I have to be here and don't?
I think because it's court mandated, I think a lot of them just look at, hey, this is one of the things I have to do to get through my court mandated program. Some of them, it may have effect, but a very small percentage have that consciousness, because what does drug use? I don't care. Pick any drug. What does it do to your consciousness, to the conscious mind? It dulls it. It changes it. And you were talking about psychosis. People don't know that they're psychotic. So it's very difficult for somebody to say, well, I have a problem with marijuana because of the industry. The industry has reduced the perception of harm so greatly, and has done, you know, the best eradication is prevention. And so if we can get to our youth and we can do effective prevention programs like Johnny's Ambassadors, and we're all Johnny's Ambassadors with Laura Stack. We have all gone through her training, and we use her training. The best prevention is, that is the best eradication, because we're going to have to stop the next generation from wanting to use drugs. And that's the only way to affect them. Now, what do I see happening with marijuana in the United States? Oh, I think they're pushing toward, full federal legalization. And unlike what we saw in the 30s, where we had prohibition with alcohol, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms got behind regulating alcohol pretty quickly. And I think within a period of maybe 10 years, the United States got control of the alcohol industry. Ditto with cigarettes. You don't see any cigarettes coming in with illegal stamps on. They got after the cigarettes pretty quickly. Marijuana has put so much money in the pocket of politicians that it's been legal since what, 96? So we're coming on to 40 years now. If we were going to get good controls on it, we would have them already. Does it mean we stop? No. Does it mean, however, that we decide that we're going to reschedule it as a drug? I don't think it's ready. But is it going to happen? I don't know. Renee, you've got a better handle on that than I do. And I do want to tell you and your listeners, it's people like myself down on the ground of marijuana that depend on people like you from ISIC, which I consider now, and I use it all the time in my education when I go and talk to city councils, the absolute gold standard of resource in the United States is ISIC. They don't want to listen to me as a policeman, but because it says DR.
They're the sponsors of this podcast, the International Academy on Science and Impact of Cannabis. We're a group of physicians and scientists, teaching on the harm. So it's great to hear that you're using the resource.
All the time, it's the gold standard. And anybody that wants to go to your library, when I talk to, and the bad thing, I would say that I was going to tell you the bad thing about California, and the good thing is that we've been so successful at illegal marijuana in the United States that we've exported it to so many other states. And for example, Oklahoma is the new California, and their illegal grows there are just are proliferating the state. And we have all these military-aged Chinese males coming across the border, and many of them are streaming into Oklahoma, and the illegal marijuana businesses in Oklahoma. And when I talked, it's funny because when I talked to other states and all these other cannabis boards, they ask me about California. They ask me about Siskiyou County, and I show them all the pictures and I explain to them all the stories. And to a person, they go like, well, we can do it better than California. And I was speaking to the commander of the West Virginia State Police, and he said, oh, we have winter weather here. There's no way we can have all this illegal marijuana. And I said, you don't understand. There are no barriers to illegal marijuana. They will burn whatever they have to burn. They will use what energy they have to use. They will grow anywhere. And look at Alaska.
I think what happens is people say, oh, well, those are the illegal grows. Of course, we're not for that, but we're for all these legal grows that are bringing all this, money and taxes, and that discrepancy. People don't realize how that filters into the legal market.
We have a legal grower here in Shasta County, a local kid. He was a concrete contractor. And in a period of 3 years, he's making $50 million a year. He boasts about it. He drives around in a Lamborghini, and he's a concrete worker, okay? And he has exported his marijuana to Canada, to Puerto Rico. He now has dispensaries up and down the state of California. He's got online business, and people think that marijuana is not sold online. In 5 minutes, Renee, you can go online and you can order marijuana, and it'll be sent through the U.S. Postal Service or UPS with a credit card, and you can get it anywhere, anytime. They don't ask it. They, you know, you check. Yeah, so 21.
This all Lamborghini that. Guy, he's a legal grower.
Yeah, he's a legal grower, but
so he's following the rules.
No. He's currently under investigation, under a confidential investigation, because we track all the grows, and we know what grows are feeding his legal business, and they're illegal grows that are feeding his legal business. But he has a legal business in a city, and I won't name the city, in a city that allows marijuana growing. He does have a marijuana growing facility, but you don't make $50 million out of this one little facility. So he's actually just using that as a vehicle to funnel all the illegal marijuana that he's growing in California into his business. And that's what's going on. Marijuana growers are very good at being criminals, and they disguise themselves with sub-S corporations, and they use other people's names, and it's very hard. The only way I think that we'll ever be able to get control of marijuana is it's going to have to be the same way that we went after Al Capone. We're going to have to use the IRS and go after him with tax violations.
All the many lobbyists and legal dispensaries that are everywhere? How do they compare to all this legal? Aren't they against the illegal grows as well? Because that's, you know, affecting their people who are doing things legally are probably paying a lot more for their business
and the legal business is getting, as you know, and I'm sure you've heard, the legal marijuana business in the state of California is in a complete disarray and state of flux. Many of them are going out of business. It's a risky business to go into now, because, and you have to be well healed financially before you go into it, because you're not going to survive that 1 to 3 year mark as a business if you want to follow every single regulation and pay every single tax.
And yet they're politically strong. Last year in California, we proposed a bill to put labels on marijuana products, just like you have labels on cigarettes and on alcohol. And before you watch a movie that may have flashing lights, it'll have a warning. We're a country who likes warning labels. And we tried to put the same type of, you know, evidence-based warning labels on cannabis products, so people are aware of, like your friend, to have episodes of psychosis and association with suicide and vomiting and drug interactions. People have the right to know that. And that proposal that should be like a no-brainer was crushed. It was killed in the Senate, and the governor would not support that. So this year we thought, okay, people don't want warning labels in the state of California. What about babies and children who are harmed? You know, maybe we care about children. And we have staggering statistics of, you know, 2 babies a day coming to children's hospital with marijuana poisoning, mostly from the candies. So this year we have the Cannabis Child Safety Act, and we'll see. But the industry is, even for protecting babies, is fighting that.
Well, you know, we're fighting a Democrat, Wiener, and of course, Mr. Wiener wants to make all drugs legal in the state of California and go down the same road as Oregon, which is now having, of course, second thoughts and has destroyed all their major cities. Portland is San Francisco North or L.A. North now, and so we're working on the candy ban and also working on the psychedelics ban behind the scenes, just like you are. And I think it's important for all the communities to know that these things are being proposed by our legislature, and they have a very real chance of passing, which is only going to result in a diminution of quality of life for all Californians.
Yeah, our nation and the future of our country, really, because normalizing drug use is another way of destroying the future of America.
again, youth prevention is the best eradication. We've got to get to them.
Right. Upstream prevention, both in supply, which you're doing also in law enforcement and in education. I agree with you. But I want to get back to what I asked you before about being targeted. And, you know, you're here in the shadows on our in our podcast. And tell us about where is that threat coming from? Is it coming, you know, I would think it would be coming from drug cartels of fentanyl or cocaine. Rather than what people think is harmless, like marijuana?
Well, it did come from cartels early on in my career, where we would take down large drug seizures. And after that, we would get pictures of us personally sent to the station, and they would have rifle scopes with your face on the rifle scope. Those never really went anywhere. When I got involved in marijuana, and I have other threats against me that involved people that committed other crimes that were psychotic and got very long prison sentences and held it against me personally, and they have come after me personally, and I have been advised by the FBI that, you know, there's a serial murderer. That I'm on his hit list. I'm right up there on top, so I'm always worried about that. And he is probably one of my top fears in my life of being found. So I live a life of anonymity. I used to appear publicly with my real name. I don't do that anymore. Locally with marijuana, when we began to battle marijuana here in Northern California around 2010. We were going to all the city council meetings and all the board of supervisors meetings, and I mean appearing every single week, speaking about the harms of marijuana. And there, I was targeted locally by I've had you know incidents of assault. I've had my home address revealed. I've had my identity revealed. I've received threats to my safety, and so I'm very careful now. When you go after marijuana, and I'm going to speak specifically about marijuana, and you go after that voraciously, and I do, I have a passion. I will never stop going after marijuana in my life. After what happened to Jeff, I will battle this drug for the rest of my life. The government can make it legal, and I will never stop battling against it. So it's pushed me into a life of anonymity, and my wife has to carry a gun. Of course, I'm armed all the time, and I'm always expecting, and I live rurally. So it's made me do things, pretty extraordinary security precautions. And I'm always wary about who's following me. And when I have to live in a heightened sense state of security all the time. And when I go into the grows and I interview growers, and I have interviewed growers, and it's interesting. I mean, the people that are actually growing the marijuana, they're victims. I mean, they're workers. It's the people that are owning those grows and making the money off them. Those are the people that are potentially dangerous, because when you take away multiple millions of dollars of income from somebody, and there, just so you know, there's been many murders in the grows up here. Many of them unreported. We know that they're cartel murders. For example, we found a body on the side of the road outside of one of the grows here. It was a Mexican national. He had his arms were wired behind his back, and his hands had been cut off, and he had been defaced. And that was absolutely a cartel murder. And it was probably don't steal from the grow. And we do get marijuana murders up here where we get they'll war when they're. It's a cash business. So, of course, there'll be a lot of marijuana robberies. We've had fake DEA agents going into grows, saying they're DEA, and then ripping off the grows. And we get wars where they'll shoot it out with each other. They don't call us, but we'll get the results of that. We'll find the bodies, whatever. So that's a real thing. That's occurring. So
there's a whole show. Was it on Netflix about Shasta Mountain and?
So you're talking about, that's called Murder Mountain, and that was it's over in Humboldt County, and that's going back a number of years now, but that is still going on, and we'll get people are trafficked into these grows, and there's a girl named Tatiana Duggar. I sent her a picture it's one of the pictures that you have. And Tatiana came out of the Bay Area. We don't know if she was a prostitute. We don't know if she, how she actually got into the gross, but she was murdered and they just threw her like trash on the side of the road. And it was, it's absolutely related to the cartels up there. These aren't innocent little people from other countries. These are narco terrorists. That's what they are. And when we decide that we're going to make them narco terrorists, then we can effectively deal with them.
Wow. That's incredible. It's hard to absorb all that's just happening with a little pushback. And I just want to say thank you so much to Charles Porter for posing the question, which you very eloquently told us about the history of drugs, how it affects marijuana. And Charles, thank you so much for the care that you have for the community, for children, and your advocacy. And for you too, Joe, amazing. Thank you so much for your service in law enforcement. We need the fine, brave men and women who protect us, because, you know, that's what allows us to be free Americans. And thank you for your passion, your education. And I appreciate that you will never give up, no matter what. You're driven and for good purpose. I really thank you.
I'm waiting for you to come up here, Ronit. We've got a plane waiting for you.
All right. Will I not be murdered? Then I'm coming.
I promise.
Okay.
Thank you, Ronit. I want to thank you and all your listeners, and I want to thank Charles for his good question. And I hope your listeners found some benefit to this podcast.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Isaac, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaicone.org, that's IASIC1.org, to view their library that translates medical journals for public understanding, listen to their speaker series, and follow the science on marijuana. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.